So let me zero in on the topic as Sanatan Dharma, or rather Kumbh Mela in the light of Sanatan Dharma, because otherwise it's a very vast ocean in which we'll be entering. So Sri Aurobindo spoke of India as a custodian of the Sanatan Dharma. It's very amazing. It's meant to preserve the Sanatan Dharma. And when the age of Kali comes, then everything shrinks and remains in a small part of the world, the soul of the world, if I may say so, that is Bharat, in which it remains confined to small narrow streams. And when the world moves again towards a greater light of truth, which must manifest itself, the Satyug, for which we all wait, then Sanatana Dharma expands, then India rises again. So it is the Leela of God. But what is Sanatana Dharma? Sanatana Dharma, of course, it's not a religion the way we understand, not at all a belief system. It is not even a way of life as we hear about it. Least of all, it is a set of rules and regulations to conduct our outer behavior. So Sri Aurobindo uses a very interesting word. He says, Sanatana Dharma is life itself. What does it mean? So what's happening in life? Sanatana Dharma has seen that life is moving towards a grand event, a grand culmination. What is in it at its core will ultimately, through a process of long efflorescence, it will manifest as the finest flower or fruit of the labor which is going on upon earth. So Sanatana Dharma is life itself in the sense that life is an unfolding of the divine. Call it Leela, call it manifestation. And Sanatana Dharma facilitates this process. It's to understand that we are here to facilitate, or rather we are not just facilitators, something else is moving us. So the whole idea of Dharma, which is part of the word Sanatana Dharma, is all that facilitates, all that helps life to grow towards vastness, towards unity, towards love at its peak, towards the joy which we all, which is, as he says, is the baptism of the soul, towards growth of light, towards truth, unwalled, unpartitioned. All that is part of the Sanatana Dharma. Dharma is that. And all that opposes it, stands against it, materially, psychologically, in whatever way, all that leads to division, disunity, fragmentation, all that becomes adharma. Now this itself evolves from age to age, because Sanatana Dharma is an ongoing unfolding of the divine. What was valid some time back is not valid as the unfolding takes place. This is the background and context. But here comes a very interesting part of the Indian way of life, that it is one civilization which has maintained a continuity through this unfolding. This is something very amazing. So in India, one of the things that everybody within this Sanatana Dharma, let's say, fold, which includes all the different indigenous religions which have come up, is in the continuity of the individual existence. And that's where rebirth comes in. Otherwise, one life makes no sense. Suddenly pop, I come up and one day I go away to some place, somewhere or nowhere. But rebirth gives a continuity to the story of life. The avatars give a continuity to the collective evolution when we look at the story. So this continuity which we see in India is amazing. And this continuity is not just in the outer storyline. It is at several levels. That's how it could maintain a continuity. So everything, even the most commonplace ritual or an action or a way of life in India, deep within, whether we know it or not, whether we have forgotten it, at least exists at three levels. So you'll see people saying, Namaskar, there is a deep spiritual level. Whom do I bow down? I bow down to the divine in you. This is a very interesting story of someone going to meet Nalanda, one of the foremost disciples of Sri Aurobindo, and he had this hesitation. I cannot touch anybody's feet except Mother and Sri Aurobindo. I had that kind of feeling. But I am going to him, it will look very odd that I don't, do some kind of pranam or something. Not only there was a yogi and he read his thoughts, and as he came near, when he stood in front, he says, you can touch my feet, not mine, but the divine mother in me. So that solved his problem. Okay. So this is the deepest level at which one does namaskar. I bow down not to you as an outer person, but to the... Then there is an occult significance of it. Many things. It trains us in humility. It trains many aspects of it. Play of forces, etc., etc. And there is the outermost gesture, which should be beautiful. So all these three levels. And when we look at Kumbh Mela, I mean, as you said, my own experience, though my reasons were very different, I have shared this. It was because my wife's 60th birthday and she asked me for this gift. And I was very hesitant. I said, it's a daunting task. Then she said, okay, alternative is Bali. I said, okay, I take this one. You know, when you have to make a person choose your bidding, give a choice. But a choice where, you know, we do this with children. Don't tell them that, you know, you must do this. You tell them, okay, you have this choice. No, they will end up, art of parenting by Divya, huh? That they will make up this choice. This is the easier. I said, this is more manageable. So that's how I went to Kumbh Mela. Of course, I've been fascinated with all these stories from childhood, and I'm aware of all the stories behind. So the deepest level, we can begin either from the deepest to the outer or outer to the deepest. Always we'll find some story is linked at the deepest level. And I am just stopping my temptation to go into so many stories that come to my mind. One of them I've shared is the story of course, Devasur Sangram. You cannot become a, well, at modern day, if I have to use this story, I would say you cannot become a claimant to immortality if you shut your eyes to the shadow within you. It is so strange. In the Sagar Manthan, you acknowledge the role of the asuras. Both must come together and do the churning. It's not enough that the gods do the churning. It's very interesting. So if we shut one side, be a good person, a holy man, saintly person, interestingly, you are not a claimant to immortality, whatever else you may get. So it's not goodness, but something much more. And then the second aspect of the story of this Sagar Manthan, from where it all starts, is many things will come. And you have to be clear that what you are waiting for and looking for. So many things come out of the Sagar Manthan. One could just stop with Uccheshrava, the flying horse, could Chandrama, all this come out. And at the end we know that before the Amrit comes, there is the poison. So if you are not ready, if you are not ready to take the poison of life, that's why the Upanishad says, one of the Upanishads, Na Yamatma Balhine Nalabhyo. He who is weak, the yoga is not for him. So all these things, poison of life, is actually a tonic for the soul, adult soul. While the infant soul shrinks from it, oh my God, it blames, complains. But the adult soul takes it like a tonic. So poison will come, and you can only take it if there is Shivat in you, the sense of the eternal. So that's the meaning of the story. Then comes Amrit. The story doesn't stop here. Now every part will begin to claim its share. The Asura says, I want power. The gods want immortality. So there is one last test, and that last test is the Vishwamohini. The divine becomes all the attractions of the world, and he says, do you want all this? And the Asura keeps his eye. Suddenly he shifts. One lesson that I have learned from this story is, keep your eyes focused on the goal. Don't look left, right, whatever is happening. 101,000 things are happening. They will happen. Not that you should be indifferent to things that are happening around you, but stay focused on the goal. This is the last test that takes place. And during the melee, well, while they are fighting, some drops fall down. Now see how the story is being connected to earth. But there is a deeper meaning to it. Shobhindani Savitri writes, earth by this golden superfluity. So there are planes beyond where events are taking place. And when events are taking this place there, they have repercussions upon earthly life. And vice versa. That's why there is the Vedic cultures grew up like this, that the gods grow by man and man grows by the gods. So every time there is goodness upon earth, the gods grow, they become stronger. Or every time there is evil which predominates, the asura grows, and so on and so forth. So there is a spilth, he has even used the word spilth from heaven. One drop, which is enough. We can tolerate that for the moment. So that's in, of course, paradise of the life God. So there is the spilth of heaven, it drops into a particular spot. Now this is the deepest part. There is another story connected with it about the spilth, that is Garuda. Garuda picks up the pot, and because there is a long story behind it, Garuda and the Nagas come together. Nagas are earthbound force, very powerful. They come from the Naklok, subconscient. They are forces which, and they go back there, that's their residence. They're very powerful. They can, a cobra can fall an elephant. So that earthbound force and Garuda, the heaven flying aspiration of man, and both come together again. And the Amrit comes, and once again things unfold, and finally there is a spilth which takes place on this spot. Then there is the occult dimension of the story. And here Sri Aurobindo mentions, because people often ask, has he said anything about Kumbh? He has revealed the esoteric significance of Ganga, Yamuna, Saraswati. So Ganga, Yamuna, Saraswati are the three nadis, the subtle channels within us. And we all know we have a side of Ganga which is quiet, pacifying, peace, which is liberating. See, that's how Ganga is. Ganga is fascinating. Ganga's story is just amazing. But she is pacifying. But just I'll quickly touch. Ganga has come from, as a result of aspiration of an earth creature, Bhagirath, and she comes all the way through Shiva and to redeem earth. How has Yamuna come? Yamuna has a very similar origin. Yamuna is daughter of Surya. You have Yama and Yami, not the English Yami, of course. So Yama and Yami were brothers, twins. And Yami comes to earth, she becomes Yamuna. So you see the difference. One comes straight, Vishnu, Aditya, and down. The other also has a similar origin. She comes here and she experiences the anguish of earth. Because she knows people die, so she is Yama's sister. And then there are several stories connected with that, but one which is very sweet, that she seeks that this earth's misery be relieved. So what does she do? She waits for the avatar. And when Krishna comes, she tries to touch his feet. That, I think we are all familiar with that story. When Vasudeva is taking Shri Krishna and going, and Yamuna is in spate, trying to touch. Again, nature is in spate, in revolution when the avatar is around. Because it's seeking, oh, here comes the Redeemer. Always, we'll see. Christ, Buddha's time, Sri Aurobindo, Sri Krishna's time, Sri Rama. Nature is in spate. The worst and the best, all of them are leaping forward. They want to touch the feet of the Lord. So, Yamuna weds Krishna. One of his wives, very few people may be aware. Anybody knows the name? She is called Kalindi. As Kalindi, she is the spouse of Krishna. And that's the maximum she can do. So we have these two channels within us. Ganga, the purifying, pacifying. And she is active, all is wonderful. You can ask anything and yeah, please take it. But then Yamuna, the restless. She cannot be pacified except when she goes to the feet of the Lord. So this is the other channel. So when we are in that Yamuna mode, so often I say people are in Ganga mode or Yamuna mode. Yamuna mode, then take God's name. Otherwise, she'll drown you. I've experienced both physically. Oh, Yamuna, torrential, and you know, storms come and you have to literally just get down. Nothing else you can do. But there has to be something which can balance these, and that's the hidden Saraswati. So again, Saraswati, civilization and lost river, there is so much written, spoken about it, and I am not going into it, but it's very interesting that Saraswati is the river which is there but runs underneath. It's not active, but the entire civilization owes itself to Saraswati. So Saraswati is the hidden current, so Ida, Pingala and Sushmana. When Saraswati rises up as a result of the mounting fire of aspiration, it's this which can pull up. And then when Saraswati rises up, and there comes a point when it balances these two. So Yamuna becomes that restless, energetic part. becomes an instrument of the divine. That's what it means. Hanuman is an instrument of the divine. And Ganga, the purifying, pacifying powers, this going together. And Saraswati brings them together. So when the three meet, we have immortality. So this is the second esoteric side of the story. Then of course there comes other occult aspects. Water, fire, India played with the elements. Why do people give to fire? Mother said that it's given to fire because it destroys all the elemental beings, what we call as Bhuta Preta and all that. And water is another which washes away. One of the things in Indian tradition, I don't know, I've been in the CHN areas with all the cold, but I have to take a bath. Why? Because my parents instilled it to me. And the water would grow cold in 3 minutes, 4 minutes. But I have to take, I can't help it. Bath is important. Now when I look back, because simple act of washing yourself with water, you don't need soap or anything, it washes away many formations that stick to us. This one part. But then why Ganga, Yamuna and Saraswati? You can wash it anywhere. Well, as a child we used to do this. Ganga, Yamuna, Saraswati, all the rivers you invoke. Now this is because India also understood the occult energies. Kumbh Mela in its present form is relatively recent, few hundred years. See how it has been connected to a story which nobody knows its origin. So you have now link between a past, hoary past and the present. But also Kumbh was an area around the rivers, people used to have these melas which were spiritual fair if you like, spiritual tourism if you like. But Kumbh was, the Prayagraj was one of the places, it's called as Tirtharaj. It's one of the places where all these fairs were going on. So a lot of spiritual people will come around the month of March and they will take a dip. 1 month they will do Kalpavas, they will stay in isolation. So that place became intensely charged because of this. And this is happening for generations after generations. I think at least 1,000 years, because there is also Mughal rule, there is a story, and then before that. Then what about the water? Very interesting, now we have Japanese study about water being charged. Can we charge water? At least Indian occult science says, yes, you can charge water. That's why you use water before we do the tarpan or anything. You put water in the hand. And before offering the meal to God, you can do it inside. You take the water and you say in the name of whatever, Brahmeva, Brahmarpano, or whatever you want to do, Om. You have charred this. Now this becomes, just like fire is a witness, water becomes, the water ritual is that. So water can be charged. And this water has been charged by so many, I am not saying about the saints and others who come, I don't know. But by people whose devotion, faith, they are taking a dip with this idea that we are going to get mukti. This itself charges the water tremendously. So this is the other part of it. But then people see also, I didn't see, maybe I am colorblind. I saw devotion, faith and lovely everything. Also mother's grace, everything went very well. But people say, no, this was dirty, that... Now, this is a very interesting letter of Sri Aurobindo. He says, when you come to the ashram, there are two atmospheres, the human and the divine. So if you see the human, you will get all kinds of things. But if you see the divine, that's what you are here for. And Rishabh Chandji, the one who wrote this biography, Sri Aurobindo's life unique, put it in a very humorous way. He says, mother, when people come here, if they see us, they wouldn't want to stay. But if they see you, they would never want to go. So there is always, always, everywhere in this world, in a grain of sand, in a leaf, patram, pushpam, phalam, toyam, in the fruit we eat, in the flower we smell, in the net of the stars, in the sky, in the bloom of the flowers, in the beauty of woman, in the blush of a girl, in the laughter of a boy. Everywhere this mix of the divine behind and the human. We see what we wish to see or what we are trained to see. Some go to Kumbh and see the crowd. some go still further, how the political establishment is. I can tell you, nobody was, it's not about political establishment, people. I was so moved. People are moving 10 kilometers with all this sheer faith. They were not bothered about what police is saying, not saying. So, some see that outer respects, some see the inner. And that's the lesson of life. Everywhere, there is the human element and there is the divine. If you look at the human side of the story, life would sometimes be a miserable hell. But if you look at the divine unfolding side, which is what Sanatana Dharma tells us, life will be most beautiful, most wonderful, most enriching. And that's my experience of the Kumbh Mela. Very beautiful, wonderful. Of course, I must add in the end, we are spoiled people. After taking constant bath in the Mahapurnakumbh, I would say. People say, so what is this Kumbh? I say Purnakumbh. Here you have divine love, divine light, divine peace. So honestly, it'll be unfair for me to say what is there, because there is spiritual energy, it's not vital energy. This I can say for sure. I have some idea of the two. Same with Banaras. Mother has also said Banaras is an occult atmosphere. But bathing here in this, well, supermind is supermind. But that's, of course, for me, there are countless people who at least even that little spilt of heaven, that drop, nectar drop, rejuvenates them and rejuvenates them for quite a long time. So that's my story. Thank you.